Mardi Gras morning started with buzzards circling the neighborhood. And it's not vultures. It was the Jefferson City Buzzards, a marching troupe. And what they were, in our, we lived in this part of town that was called a Yat part of town, and that's short for Where Yat. And that's an expression that was used by sort of working to lower class, usually white people. And they called themselves Yats, and we ended up renting a place there. So we lived with the Yats. And they had this crew, this troupe, which was a band of merry men who, in the morning of Mardi Gras, would put on these strange tunics, usually iridescent, some color, and run out in the street. And they had a float put together, a tiny little slapdash float that was pulled by a tractor. And on the float sat a ragtag team of Dixieland musicians. And they were called the Buzzards. They had some big banner that said, you know, we are the Buzzards and we are here or something. And they would run. The troupe would kind of go circling through the neighborhood and gathering its members. So you'd hear at 7:30 in the morning on Mardi Gras Day, you'd hear, you know, the sound of the music approaching. And you'd see your neighbors, the men, running out of the house to join the troupe, you know, to join up. And sometimes they'd be putting on their tunic as they ran out. Wives would be chasing, or significant others were chasing after with their beer, usually, because they forgot that. 7:30 in the morning. Honey, your beer! And so one of them was carrying some beads, like put it on and gave him a big kiss and left. Some of them didn't wear the tunics. They dressed in costume and drag. And one man, when we would go out, when we'd hear the music, that was our alarm clock on Mardi Gras Day, and we'd go out on our porch and have our coffee in our bathrobe and watch the buzzards pass. And one year, a man dressed in drag came running up onto the porch and gave Gabriel a big kiss and said, "Happy Mardi Gras!" And I was like, "Yes, cheers!" After the buzzards passed, we lived there for a few years. We'd go inside, and Gabriel would make mimosas at 8 o'clock in the morning, and we would start to put on our costumes. And that was the beginning of Mardi Gras Day, but it actually was the end of Mardi Gras season. It marked the end of Mardi Gras season, because Mardi Gras season actually starts on Twelfth Night, which is the 12th night after Christmas, and that's when the season kicks in high gear. In New Orleans, I remember when I first moved there, people told me, you know, Christmas isn't so big around here. It's kind of when we rest up and get ready. And I was like, what? So, and sure enough, it was like really low-key and quiet during Christmas, pretty but quiet. And then on Twelfth Night, it all starts happening. The city starts to unravel. And what happens is there's parades, they start small. Little satirical neighborhood parades would start coming out, and they'd be very risque, very very political, lots of political satire. I was looking at some pictures recently, and there was all this political satire that I didn't even get because it was so specific to that 1972, some politician who really bugged everybody. They had a big papier-mâché head of him, you know, with a knife in it or something. You know, it's just really ridiculous. And then they also do not only political satire, and, you know, like after Katrina, one of the biggest ones was poor Mayor Ray Nagin was just lambasted in these parades constantly in all different, because nobody felt he had done a good enough job after Katrina. But they also, of course, go the sexual route, and you will have the most crude representations of anatomy done with paper mache, like massive paper mache. And you have to sit there and think, they were in someone's garage. These people were like applying, you know, paper mache to balloons or whatever it was, you know. And then, oh yeah, then we'll paint it here. And we need to do something to, you know, and in, you know, for months they would do this. And then they would push this massive thing down, and they'd all be enrobed in different costumes, just equally offensive, and throwing offensive throws and whatnot. And it was just great. That's the early stuff. That's the stuff that happens after, right after Christmas. That's the stuff that that the locals really love. And as time goes on, the parades get more and more enormous, more and more lit up with electric light bulbs rather than flames or whatever other people are using. And they get more and more kind of preposterous in Hollywood, and what you see on TV now is just sort of, I think, what it's just gotten completely outlandish. But so the early stuff is what's fun, but what happens over these months between Epiphany and actual Mardi Gras Day is a gradual deterioration of the city. It starts with things like your boss is gone for 2 hours at lunch instead of one, and he comes back. Maybe he shouldn't be back. And, And then things like strange traffic jams because somebody decided to have a party in the middle of the street. Or there's a marching band practicing, and they just take up the whole street, and you got to reroute your traffic. People start coming in from out of town more and more. And some of them are tourists, but some are regulars who seem to go from, you know, festival to festival to festival, either selling their hot dogs or whatever, or just participating. The city gets weirder and weirder. You'll start hearing singing. You'll turn around, and somebody will be getting out of a car in this massive feathered ensemble and going into a building. For 2 seconds, you see this, like, amazing, did I just see that? And then, you know, that picks up with frequency to the point where it's close to Mardi Gras, you know. You go to work on Lundi Gras, which is the Monday before Mardi Gras. You go there as a point of, you know, purpose. But then that night you go home and the city just stops. The mail stops. Everything stops. The only thing that's still open is, like, bars and places to get, you know, food and whatnot. And you go – you've also this whole time been planning your costume. And you've been building it, whatever, however crazy it is, or you've been planning your whole social agenda, where you're going to go, what you're going to do, and all that kind of thing. So Mardi Gras comes up, and on Mardi Gras Day, as you know, coming back to where we were, Gabriel and I would get dressed, and we'd head out into the city. And that's the best part. It never rained for some reason on Mardi Gras. We just always would get to just go hit the city and see what we could see. And one of the things I remember... let me just try to make sure I don't forget any of these things. So there are some early morning parades, too. There's a parade that's put on by an African-American crew called Zulu. And Zulu, it's very interesting what they do. They started out as a crew that kind of mocks the white crews. And so they would have sort of hyperboles of what a king, hyperboles of these different characters on their floats. They would also paint themselves in blackface and white around the mouth, and it was like a form of defiant minstrelsy, like, we are kind of spitting this back in your face, and their throws were these giant coconuts, and which were dangerous, yes, that's dangerous. They paint them in elaborate, like, sparkles and everything, and your goal in life is to catch a coconut from Zulu. People save the coconuts for years. And Zulu was the first parade on Mardi Gras morning, the first big parade, and it would then be followed by Rex. But as a point of pride, Zulu always ran late, determined, so that the Rex was always held up for at least 1 or 2 hours waiting for Zulu to finish. That was a point. The Rex was the traditionally white parade. And then you'd go into – but we usually just kind of dabbled on the fringes of those, and we would go into the quarter. And in the fringe quarter, one of the things you hear just constantly is music. And it is both everything from brass music to just plain drumming in the streets to Dixieland and to more the big beats that come out of people's cars when they're driving past. You are never away from this steady rhythm. We'd go into the French Quarter, and as you walk in there, that's just when it's just amazing. You look around, and everyone is masked. Everyone is dressed in some sort of amazing costume. Not everyone. But there are things that you'll just stop and stare for a while, and you just start getting this feeling like you're riding on some kind of wave, like you're in just some sort of surreal moment. And what happens is you'll look around and you'll see your colleague, somebody you hardly ever talk to, maybe seen in the office a few times, entirely naked, painted in blue. You know, and you'll see your mailman over here, maybe, you know, feathered, out of control feathers, you know. This is the person who brings your mail every day, and you maybe say hello right there. And you will greet each other like you're the best friends. Oh, my God, you look great, you know. And, oh, happy Mardi Gras. And you'll do that point to point, and you start to reconsider everyone that you've seen, because all of a sudden you see some part of them. You see them in a way that they want you to see them for that day. And you see this this energy and this man who wears – the mailman suit actually perceives himself to be feathered, you know? And, I mean, it's just amazing. The other thing that happens, the quarter is kind of split, and there's a street called St. Anne, and on this one side of St. Anne is the gay side of the although everything spills over in the quarter, but the gay parade on Mardi Gras Day is just that's, like, over the top, you know? And there are costumes that, like one man will have a costume that is so massive that he needs four other men to help him carry the costume and walk around the street. You know, like that's the type of thing. There was one costume that we saw where there was a man was dressed as a pope. And he had was on a throne, and he had this amazing multicolored, sparkling kind of halo effect they were able to produce on his throne. And he had four bears. He was like in a litter with four men carrying him. And it was such a – and he could barely move, and they kept kind of running into problems on corners, you know. And I remember – you know, and the sun would come and sparkle on his costume, and it was just so amazing. But what I also remember looking at is looking over and seeing what we called were Iowegians, which is probably derogatory. But it was people from Iowa or elsewhere who came down to New Orleans thinking it would be quaint and interesting to see how the locals celebrate. And they would wear maybe a bead and, you know, maybe they thought they did their hair that day and they look, you know, festive. And they would stand and just stare at – I remember this one family where the mother almost – you could tell her she was almost protecting her children from seeing that pope. And I was just fascinated because they were just, they were probably maybe Catholic, I don't know, but it's something in them hit them in a way that they couldn't process. And I remember feeling like that's so fascinating. But I say that, and yet it happened to me. Because we all have, you know, we all have our, like, point where we're not comfortable anymore. And that's what I actually love about Mardi Gras. But what happened to me was that year, Gabriel was dressed in a, I think it might have been the year, I don't know. He was dressed in a hazmat suit from head to toe, Tyvek hazmat suit with goggles. And he was carrying something with a, like that, and he would pretend to spray people when he would walk by. And I was dressed in some kind of feather thing, and my friend was dressed as an Egyptian pharaoh or something. And we were walking, and we saw somebody had made a papier-mâché golden calf, which they were pushing around on a shopping cart. And every now and then they would stop and all bow to it. And this, like, it hit me. Like, I couldn't stand – something in me, like, thou shalt have no God before the golden calf. And something in me, like, no matter – I'd even had a mimosa by then, but it's still, like, you know. And I realized that that's what it's for. That's what Mardi Gras is for. It's for, like, in your face, like, remember this. You know, you're supposed to be afraid of this. And I just love that moment where you just the other thing that happens is you start to see – familiar characters. So in the beginning of the day, you'll see somebody, we saw a couple dressed entirely in AstroTurf. And you walk around the quarter and you see them again. You know, maybe you'll see the AstroTurf couple and then you see the AstroTurf couple. There's another couple who were very tall and skinny, and then they had these wear it in Lycra suits, but then they had these gigantic mushroom heads with, you know, polka dots on them. They were giant mushrooms walking around the city, you know, and you just see the mushrooms. So there are the mushrooms. No, it's over past the AstroTurf people, and there are the mushrooms over there. You start to see these images that they start. There was one family that made a giant banana, which they pushed their child around on. And that's another thing. It actually is family-oriented. Some, you know, maybe not for Iowegians, but it is. You actually do bring, I mean, the kids come, they get masked too, and they just look around and they soak it in. And they don't, you know, there are families who work the whole costuming into with their kids, and they do the whole thing. We did that one year with Hyacinth when she was a brand new baby. We had Hyacinth that we brought her to her first Mardi Gras. We put little paint on her cheeks. But it is a family thing for people who live there. There are also some people who wear the same costumes year after year, and that's always interesting because they really stick to what they think they are. So there's one man called the Moss Man who would go get Spanish moss, which drapes off the live oak trees, and drape himself. And somehow he managed to make it stick, and he'd just walk around the city. So you'd see, if you saw a Moss Man, you'd check. You know, that was that Mardi Gras was, you know. And our friend Matt used to dress, he's Mexican, and he used to dress as a Mexican wrestler. But he would exaggerate his Mexican features so that they were just absurd, you know, the total stereotype to the point. And he had written across El Misantropo, you know, the misanthrope. And the pictures, and every time you try to take a picture of him, he would go like this. You know, I mean, it's like, Matt, stop. Can you just smile for one? You know, it was just great. And And there was a lot of cross-dressing and people exploring everything they wanted to explore, whether it was anything you wanted to try out or you thought you had in you and you wanted to be, you could be. And there's a level of tolerance and acceptance and fun that happens. We, as far as just what we did, we would go into the hotels. Bars and hotels were respites. They were air-conditioned. They had water, clean bathrooms. There was one bar in the Monteleone that has a bar that goes around in a circle, like it slowly moves around over the course of an hour. And that was always a fun bar to go to anyway, but on Mardi Gras Day, it was like a scene out of Star Wars, that bar where they have all those weird characters. So you have all these people sitting around this round bar kind of slowly rotating, and there was one man who was completely nude except for a loincloth, just a middle-aged, overweight man, bald, sitting there drinking a beer with his loincloth, and it was just, that's the type of thing that they just, those are the images that are just so fantastic that just break open the way you see yourself, the way you see other people, the way you see your city. And they put you in touch with this absurd thing that is just so fantastic. There was lots of drinking, although Mardi Gras is more of a marathon than a sprint. So locals do not get hammered and then collapse all over the place for the most part. You learn to pace yourself. You eat a lot. You dance a lot. You drink a lot of water. There was a lot of dancing, just tons of it. Sometimes there would be dancing in the street where somebody would just have a bunch of, drums, and you just dance for hours and hours and hours and talk to people and then dance. There were some of our friends. I knew two couples who suspended their marriage for the day. I knew one person a couple people who used to do acid. That was the one time of the year that they would drop acid. So, I don't know. I would think that would be like over the top, but they planned it. They got organized, and so by the end of what we would do by the end of the day, we'd be exhausted. We started at 7:30. By dinner time, we were around home, and we took our showers and just crashed and went to bed. Now the city sometimes does party, mostly out of towners who think go into the night, and then the cops come out around midnight and they start getting everybody off the street. They bring out crews of convicts to clean up the city, not the greatest, and they start the cleanup process, which is massive, at about midnight, because on midnight the Ash Wednesday begins, which is the beginning of Lent. And we all went to work. You go to work the day after Mardi Gras. The people who don't go to work the day after Mardi Gras are like the people who haven't been here long enough. They're too soft, You go to work, and you just start up again. And people would get the ash on their forehead oftentimes if they're Catholic. And that was the end. That was the end of the Mardi Gras day. Now, one of the things that's most important to me about Mardi Gras is we always talk about removing the veils, take off the mask. You want people to see you for who you really are. But I feel, and I learned from Mardi Gras, that you can't sometimes do that without ironically putting on a mask. It's at least sometimes. So Mardi Gras, the history of it, it's connected with the spring to the winter, the death of winter and the birth of spring, the festivals. There are versions of Mardi Gras and carnival all over the world. Africa has a long tradition, not necessarily of carnival, but of masking. And of ceremonies of connecting with other spirits through mask. There's an African concept called an Ngungun, which is a spirit. It's the collective spirit of the ancestors. And you wear masks. Now, Africa is a massive continent, so I'm talking in generalities here. But among some African cultures, they have ceremonial costumes, ceremonies that where they wear masks to commune with their ancestors. And they divine wisdom from their ancestors, and they slip into kind of a trance where their ancestor helps them communicates with them. So African masks are these amazing artistic things as well as being ceremonial. But something interesting about when I was reading about African masks is that they're not necessarily to hide the wearer, but rather to protect ordinary individuals from the searing gaze of the wearer in a state of ritual unity with his forebears. So the idea of the mask is for the other people, not the wearer. It was kind of interesting to me. in Europe, we have the long tradition of Celtic in bulk in the ceremony of the festival around the end of winter and the beginning of the birth of spring. In Rome, we have there was Lupercalia, which was a circus-like festival in mid-February, which Plutarch described Lupercalia, of which many write that it was anciently celebrated by shepherds, as the end of winter, beginning of spring, purification through excess and wild abandon, and has also some connection with Arcadian Lycia. At this time, many of the noble youths and the magistrates run up and down through the city naked for sport and laughter, striking those they meet with shaggy thongs. I don't know what a shaggy thong is, but Saturnalia was another one. It was end of December, early January festival. It was a time when slaves were allowed to disrespect their masters. And that's an important part of carnival. It's subversion. It's defying the natural order for a while. Bacchanalia is another one that occurred in mid-March, and it was mostly women originally, and it was women and slaves usually. And there was always rumors that the Bacchanalian women were going to overthrow the government. There are old traditions in southern Germany. Carnival was when you'd chase away the spirit, the evil spirit of winter, by wearing costumes around that time. So then Catholicism, when Rome embraced Christianity, they adopted along a lot of the festivals and the times of years to celebrate certain things. And the idea of, you know, Jesus' death and then rebirth happening around the same time, the death of winter, birth of spring, death of Jesus, rebirth, it meshed, and they adopted carnival into a Catholic custom. A lot of medieval celebrations were about defiance, where the serfs would act as lords for the day, and the lords would supposedly act as serfs, although I don't know if that's actually true. I wanted to just stop and play a piece of music, the medieval one that we've got. It's actually not medieval, it's Renaissance, but it's a festival music. It's like it's good. And if we could go back for a second and play the African one, I forgot to pause and do that. This is a mask festival in Africa. Thank you. Purim is a Jewish festival of drinking, noisemaking, and celebration that occurs in early spring around the same time. The story of Purim, it's based on the book of Esther, and she helped save the Jews from somebody who wanted to destroy them. And it's a celebration because she was successful in saving them. And so they celebrate with loud music in synagogue. You are supposed to drink so much on Purim that you can't tell the difference between a good person and a bad person. And the other thing that's interesting, a lot of kids for Purim wear masks because in the story of Esther, God is never mentioned by name. So they talked a lot about that, rabbis and scholars, and said, why wasn't God met? Well, he was masked behind the work that Esther was doing. And so the concept of God being masked and the concept of wearing masks came out of that from Purim. In Protestant tradition, which is where I was raised, there really isn't too much masking. There is some festivals in Denmark and some carryover, from Catholic festivals in Germany and Switzerland, but there really isn't a tradition of a period of time of wild abandon, and nor is there one in Muslim. In some Muslim groups who have masking customs that predate Islam. So, for example, the Ivory Coast in Africa does have a strong masking tradition and some ceremonies that incorporate masks. And in Southeast Asia as well, Islam there does have some masking. Asia is interesting because Chinese New Year occurs at the same time, right, as Mardi Gras. And the Chinese don't around that time use masks on themselves, but they do, when I was reading about it, what they do is they decorate their homes in red, because red is traditionally scares away the mythical monsters that arrive at the end of the old year, beginning of the new. So you basically mask your home in red to scare away the monster. And I don't, this is totally talking out, but when I studied Asian history in college, the concept in Asia often, the individual is not the primary unit, it is the family. Whereas in West, we think of ourselves individuals. In Asian cultures, it's often the family is the smallest unit you can think of. So it kind of might make sense that you would decorate your home rather than your person if you're going to, it's a form of masking, possibly. So in the New World, you know, everybody came to the New World, there's a confluence of European, African, and Native American traditions. And a lot of European carnival traditions got Africanized. And Africans were subjugated in the New World. So they had a limited ability to express some of their traditional ceremonies. So at the time of a carnival, the Europeans generally kind of were a little bit more loose. If you look at the history in New Orleans, Trinidad, elsewhere. And so that was when carnival just sort of exploded. It was an avenue for expression for one time of the year. Trinidad, a lot of it is too subversive because a lot of what you're expressing and what you're saying is that you are not I am not what you think I am all year round. And masking is often outlawed in many, especially during slave times, because if you can't see somebody's face, you don't know whether you're supposed to be their master or whether that's who that is right there. You're all equal if you're all masked because you can't see. So during carnival, masking laws were traditionally suspended, and it was the first time in the year that the only time when you can actually go around on the street wearing a mask. There's always been a subversive element, and there's always been talk about how in Mardi Gras was the time when whites and blacks would dance together and all these rumors about that type of thing. There are traditions of carnival in Mexico, in Haiti, just almost anywhere you can go. We could play for a minute the Mexican carnival music. And there are some modern takes on this. Australia has a Mardi Gras, and it's an entirely gay and lesbian event, which was kind of grew out of the 70s, out of the Stonewall riots, and they decided to have a Mardi Gras there. And now it's become a massive tourist event. It is a profound display of defiance. We are here, and you're going to see it. And you may not like to see it, but you're going to see it in a way that you don't want to see it. And we're going to celebrate who we are, and this is it, you know. And this is so Mardi Gras has taken on that. And we also have, of course, we have Halloween, which is different, but it still incorporates some of the same ideas of being something else for a while during kind of a liminal time in the calendar. So I want to just talk a little bit about, in ancient Latin, persona means mask. And Carl Jung talked about, to the extent that I understand him, he talked about the persona is, you know, the social face that you present to the world. And a strong ego will be able to navigate different personas flexibly. You don't want to identify too much with one persona. So like the piano player with the piano, or the singer with her voice, the professor with his textbook. You will become too brittle if you have just one persona. You need to be able to navigate all the personas. But the goal is individuation, where you need to, you know, get rid of any personas that aren't working for you and aren't reflecting who you really are, and bring on new personas that are as close as you can make them to your authentic self. You're going to still have to have them. You can't be persona free. You have to have some masks you wear, because that's civilization. But how you want to find the ones that help you be who you are. Jacques Lacan, the French psychoanalyst, he proposed that self-identity is impossible. The identity of something, its singularity or oneness, is always split. There is always too much of something, an indivisible remainder, or a bit left over. I just love that idea that you can never fit into one thing. And he talks about how if it's because of this predicament, it's because that we can't fully embody everything we are at one time, that sometimes that develops into things like racism, because you place on the other person all those things that you can't be, and you, it produces anxiety, and so they become the other, and that you you don't like. And I'm trying to think how to explain this better, but you know how we have ministers who will rail and rail and rail against homosexuality, and then it turns out they actually are gay? Well, it's like they placed on that the part of them that they can't deal with, so they hate it. And in a similar way, we often will hate the things that actually fear us the most about ourselves. And Anais Nin, who's a writer, said, she just described once having been invited to this party where they were asked to dress as their neuroses, to wear a costume. I know. And so I still think about, like, what would I wear? You know, like, I would have mini costumes. A Freudian slip. Ah, oh, Pam! So, so I just love that idea. And my friend Mark Danberg was raised Jewish, and he in college in Minnesota, he started doing pagan religion. And I remember being troubled by this. You can tell I have like an Old Testament issue, but I was like, how could you leave this tradition? You know, and what about the idea of one God? There's only one God. And Mark said, I still think there's only one God, but I think that there are facets of God, and we can never ever see the one God, so we have to kind of get at it from different facets of God. And pagan religion to me is accessing different facets of God, different masks that God wears. There's Gerard Atching, I'm not sure if that's how you say it, but he taught at NYU. And he wrote a book about Carnival in Trinidad, and he talks about how we all not only put masks on ourselves, we place masks on others. So if the first thing you see about somebody is their skin color or their weight, you have just put a mask on that person. You've masked their humanity and anything else they might be. We use masks ourselves, and we put them on other people. In Romeo and Juliet, Romeo, you know, goes to Juliet's father, has this big masquerade party to try to get his daughter to hook up with Paris. And that's when Romeo shows up. That's when Romeo's family goes to the party, because they can go under guise of mask, right? So they show up, and that's when Romeo falls in love with Juliet. They're both masked. They don't know what they should know. But in fact, that mask allows them to find the love that they wouldn't have found. Of course, it doesn't end well, but so William Butler Yeats dealt a lot, Irish poet who died in 1939, dealt a lot with masking in his writing. And there's one poem I'm going to read to you. It's a conversation between a man and a woman. And well, no, that is just so wrong. I don't know if it's between a man or a woman or a man. That's how I imagine it, but it could be two men, two women. The one person says, "Put off that mask of burning gold with emerald eyes." And then the other says, "Oh, no, my dear, you make so bold to find if hearts be wild and wise and yet not cold." And the first says, "I would but find what's there to find, love or deceit. It was the mask engaged your mind and after set your heart to beat, not what's behind. But lest you are my enemy, I must inquire. Oh, no, my dear, let all that be. What matter? So there is but fire in you and me." I've read what that means. I mean, different people interpret it differently, but it's sort of, in some ways, all that matters if the mask produces the feeling, that might be just as real as what's behind the mask. You know, it might be the mask is a part of the thing. The most important thing is the emotion behind it, not the face. The emotion, but I don't think I'm getting that entirely. I'm not explaining it right to you. I'm going to leave that. Maybe we can talk about that during our sharing. But anyway, I also wanted to mention, this is the complexity part of it. A lot of Mardi Gras has been, co-opted by the state. So Venetian Mardi Gras is a folk tradition, but it is completely now run. It was kind of revived and made a state thing by the government to produce tourist dollars, and the same in New Orleans and same in Trinidad. So that is a kind of a juxtaposition where it's sort of folk and it's sort of organic, and then in other ways it's very state-imposed increasingly. Two more things I just want to talk about, and then we'll do some sharing, is the day-to-day masking that we all do. We're talking about this in terms of a big celebration that happens once a year, but we all mask aspects of our sexuality. We mask our hair color, or at least I do. we mask our emotions. It's a day-to-day thing that we all do, and it's not, in my mind, necessarily a moral issue. It's sort of a human condition. In conclusion, masking is about, for me, a defiance, freedom, subversion, release, expression. Carnival celebrations are a purification that comes from wild abandon. The identity on display by ironically wearing a mask or costume. The mask is a silent language that is universally understood. It's not about taking off the mask. It's about what mask you choose to wear when, and then wearing it well. And then I would just open it up with some questions, like, when do you mask? What is your carnival? We've lived in New York, and we're kind of like, when do we get to go crazy? I'm sorry, but Christmas doesn't do it, you know? Spaghetti night doesn't do it. it's great, but that's a piece of our lives that has been really missing since we moved here. And we don't know where to put that. We don't know where you guys go with it, where it happens to it.
My house.
Your house. I did read one thing that I can't remember. I think it might have been Orson Welles who said that, you know, cultures who work so hard, they don't when they have holidays, they have to rest. You know, they don't want to go party. And in New York and places like that where we all work so hard, maybe we don't have any energy left over for craziness. Or maybe we don't have, I don't know. I don't know why we don't. Don't need it, don't seem to need it. Or maybe we do, and I'm not seeing it. But thank you. So I'll turn it over for any sharing.